welcome to this week's Digest edition of the Herald Scotland, from Thursday the 5th to Thursday the 12th of April 2018, read by volunteers at Cuan Review Print Speaking to the Blind at her studios in the Bishopriggs Media Centre. Coming up in Part 1.
£2,000 bill for repairs as police fill up cars with wrong fuel.
SNP is wildly irresponsible on China's Confucius Institutes.
Russia threatens to launch strikes against US military if Syria is attacked.
Stuart Cosgrove leads team to bring Channel 4 headquarters to Glasgow.
Team Scotland pass medal target.
Sir Billy Connolly, I dislike people who write England off because they're Scottish.
Success for Festival of Silent Film. New contemporary art store opens. Rewind Scotland returns.
Rebus moves from page to stage. Rankin's detective brought to theatrical life in new mystery, Long Shadows.
Scottish Government seeks derogation on three crop rule.
Crude price rally may have helped some firms in North Sea supply chain.
Tesco's turnaround looks complete as supermarket giant sees profits soar.
This article from the Herald on Monday the 9th of April 2018. News. £2,000 bill for repairs as police fill up cars with wrong fuel. This article by Sandra Dick. Scottish police officers wasted more than £2,000 of taxpayers' money last year after filling their patrol vehicles with the wrong fuel. They got it wrong at the fuel pump 16 times, leaving vehicles having to be taken off the road for costly repairs. Across the UK, officers mistakenly filled up with the wrong fuel nearly 300 times in 2017, costing the taxpayer more than £50,000 to correct the blunder. The Taxpayers Alliance said the figures, released following a Freedom of Information investigation by the Press Association, were staggering. John O'Connell, Chief Executive of Pressure Group, the Taxpayers Alliance, said, "This careless attitude shows a lack of respect for those same taxpayers who pay their wages and are forced to pay for the repairs. Millions of people manage this task with their own cars by taking a modicum of care. Police officers should extend the same courtesy to their vehicles. It's staggering that such a simple mistake is being made almost daily." Details of Police Scotland's fuel blunders emerged as the National Force remains under the spotlight over how it spends its £1.1 billion. Police Scotland is expected to find £1 billion in savings by 2026. Recently it emerged the force plans to cut the number of officers by 100 in a move to save the organisation £2.7 million. The move has been criticised by Labour, Liberal Democrat and Conservative MSPs and the Scottish Police Federation. The jobs cut plan is against a background of revelations that Police Scotland spent nearly £18 million on consultants and outside contractors in the last financial year, including £1,000 a day spent on an interim director of people and development. Another recent report showed Police Scotland has spent more than £115 million on overtime payments since it was created 5 years ago. Last year alone, £16.3 million was spent on overtime. However, at the other end of the scale, it emerged at the weekend that new police recruits have been told to bring their own paper to training sessions if they wanted printed lesson notes, with printer cartridges apparently only distributed if they are deemed business critical. Out of the UK's 45 police forces, 33 admitted paying out for repairs to a police vehicle after a misfueling incident last year at an average cost of £178 a time. Five forces did not respond. In all, some 299 incidents of misfueling were recorded, costing a total of £53,337. West Midlands Police recorded the most incidents, 66, at a cost of £3,737. West Midlands Police Fleet Manager Gary Mallett said mistakes increased after 2013 when the force moved away from internal fuel sites and fuel keys to external fuel stations in a cost-cutting exercise. Meanwhile, the Met Police had 49 incidents, costing £17,589.57 in total to repair. A spokesman there said that since 2008, its vehicles had been refuelled 1.5 million times and mistakes were a tiny proportion of total refuelling. Motoring organisations believe the problem will be eradicated completely when police forces adopt more electric cars. AA President Edmund King said, "Perhaps we need a little more detective work at the pumps to ensure the right fuel goes in the right car. Until all police cars are electric, we will probably see misfueling problems." A Police Scotland spokesman said, "The number of misfueling incidents that have occurred with Police Scotland is rare, and therefore the figure is small." Holyrood's Justice Committee marked the fifth anniversary of the merger of Scotland's regional police forces by announcing an inquiry which will examine how effective the move has been. This article by Sandra Dick.
SNP is wildly irresponsible on China's Confucius Institutes. An article by David Leask, chief reporter, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 10th of April 2018. Nicola Sturgeon has been accused of being wildly irresponsible after ploughing hundreds of thousands of pounds into an education scheme run by China's communist government. The First Minister, on the first day of a visit to Beijing, announced £745,000 of new funding for the controversial language learning programme, which is sparking growing international concern over academic freedom and propaganda. Ms Sturgeon, who is on a trade and investment visit, said the new money for Confucius Institutes would help more young Scots improve their Chinese in China. Her announcement came despite academics in America, Canada, Sweden and other countries ending their relationship with Confucius Institutes, whose teachers are under instruction to stick to party lines on keystone issues like Tibet and Taiwan. Green MSP Ross Greer said, "Allowing the Chinese regime to expand their influence through Scottish schools and universities is a wildly irresponsible move from the First Minister. The Confucius programme is boycotted by academics and organisations across the world, and the wider Chinese project of education outreach is under investigation by the American FBI. So why do the Scottish government believe it is suitable here? I can think of few other countries which are studied on terms set by the government of that country, and certainly not governments with such a long and violent history of crushing dissent." Ross Greer, MSP, says Scotland now has the highest concentration of Confucius Institutes in the world, but only negligible homegrown expertise in China. A Scottish Government spokeswoman claimed all teaching in Scottish schools met Scottish standards and used Scottish materials. She said, "Resources supplied by Confucius Institute headquarters are not promoted by the Confucius Institute for Scotland Schools, CISS. Instead, teachers in Scotland's Confucius classrooms are required to teach according to Curriculum for Excellence, in the same way as other teachers working in Scottish schools. The regime in Beijing has always been frank about the role it expects its language learning programme to play. As long ago as 2011, Politburo member Lee Chang-chun described Confucius Institutes as, quotes, "an important part of China's overseas propaganda setup," end of quotation. Some academics overseas have warned of a climate of self-censorship. Last month, the United States ordered Confucius Institutes to register as foreign agents and announced they were under FBI investigation. Last week, Texas A&M became the latest U.S. college to terminate a deal with the Confucius Institute after two local congressmen, a Democrat and a Republican, declared it a threat to national security. For some years, Scottish language teaching experts have also questioned the focus on Chinese, especially in schools. Dan Tierney, formerly of Strathclyde University, described the subject as difficult and less relevant than European languages. One linguist responding to the announcement said, "The 'we should all learn Chinese' meme is a good soundbite, but it's almost entirely unrealistic." Ms. Sturgeon, however, said the work of the Confucius Institute for Scottish Schools has helped to engage more of our young people in learning about the culture, history and language of China through the growing network of Confucius classrooms.
The Herald Scotland, Wednesday the 11th of April 2018, News Section. Russia threatens to launch strikes against US military if Syria is attacked. This article by Michael Settle. Russia has threatened to shoot down any US missile launched against Syria and warned it would target any American plane, warship or submarine behind the strike. In a ramping up of the diplomatic rhetoric, Alexander Zaspkin, the Russian envoy to Beirut, said, "If there is an American strike, then we will shoot down the missiles and target the positions from where they were launched. In the past few days, we have seen an escalation towards a significant crisis." General Sir Richard Barons, former commander of UK Joint Force Command, responding to Mr. Zaspian's comments, said, "Well, I hope the ambassador's chosen his words very carefully, because what he's actually saying is, if the US and allies decide to strike against Syrian chemical weapons and delivery aircraft, not only are they going to try and shoot down the missiles in flight, which they are capable of doing, but won't be with total success, but by saying the words launch platforms, he's saying they are going to try and sink ships, sink submarines, and shoot aircraft out of the sky. That's war," he insisted. The ambassador's comments came as the World Health Organization, WHO, demanded immediate unhindered access to Douma, the suburb of Damascus, where the suspected chemical strike took place on Saturday evening. On Tuesday night at the United Nations, Russia vetoed a US proposal to set up an investigation into chemical weapons use in Syria. This was the 12th time Russia had used its veto power at the Security Council to block action targeting Syria. Earlier, the Organisation for Prevention of Chemical Warfare said it was preparing to send a team to Douma shortly. The WHO said an estimated 500 patients went to health facilities with signs and symptoms consistent with exposure to toxic chemicals after the suspected attack. Peter Salama, the organisation's Deputy Director General for Emergency Preparedness and Response, said, "WHO demands immediate unhindered access to the area to provide care to those affected, to assess the health impacts, and to deliver a comprehensive public health response." It is estimated that as many as 70 people died in the attack on Douma. The regime of Bashar al-Assad has denied responsibility, while Moscow insisted that no chemical attack took place. Meanwhile, European air traffic controllers have issued a rapid alert for airlines in the eastern Mediterranean over the possibility of airstrikes into Syria during the next 72 hours. The European Aviation Security Agency's warning of possible launches of air-to-ground strikes or cruise missiles comes as the US, Britain, France and allies weigh up retaliatory measures to the suspected chemical weapon attack. On Monday, Donald Trump spoke of a forceful response within 48 hours, i.e. by today. At Westminster, Theresa May is expected to make a common statement on Syria on Monday when MPs return from their Easter recess. In August 2013, her predecessor David Cameron failed in his bid to get parliamentary backing for military action against the Assad regime following a chemical attack on the Syrian people. On Tuesday, the Prime Minister spoke to the US President and France's Emmanuel Macron. All agreed that the international community needed to respond to the suspected chemical weapon attack. However, reports suggested that she wanted more proof about the source and nature of the strike on Douma. Asked if he wanted to see a parliamentary vote if Britain did take military action against the Assad regime, Tory MP John Barron told BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "In the large part, yes, because we've been here before and many of us believe we need to approach this in a cautious manner because of the risk of escalation." The Essex MP added, "If there is going to be significant military intervention, then Parliament has every right to ask questions, particularly given our poor track record on previous interventions across the region." Labour MP Emma Reynolds said, There should be a parliamentary vote and indeed an urgent debate on Monday when we come back from recess. I feel strongly that the international community cannot stand by and let President Assad use chemical weapons against his own people with impunity, and that there is a clear objective of any military action, and that is to prevent him from using these weapons against his own people, innocent civilians, including children, to prevent him from doing that again. The Wolverhampton MP said that with hindsight, Labour had been wrong to vote against reacting to the use of chemical weapons in 2013, claiming that it had set a dangerous precedent. This article was by Michael Settle.
Stuart Cosgrove leads team to bring Channel 4 headquarters to Glasgow. An article by Phil Miller, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 10th of April 2018. The broadcaster and writer Stuart Cosgrove is to lead Glasgow's bid to attract Channel 4's new national headquarters to the city. Cosgrove is known to the channel. He serves as its first controller of arts and entertainment and was also head of programmes for nations and regions until 2015. He is to chair a new board which will lead the pitch to build the new broadcasting base in the city. The bid last night received backing from leading television executives. Mark Hedgeco, the head of Pacific Key Productions at BBC Studios, said, "We are very excited about Glasgow's bid. BBC Studios has a range of production bases around the UK and has a commitment to making programmes outside London. Given Pacific Key Productions are based in Glasgow, we are well aware of the huge attractions and advantages of making programmes in the city. We fully back the bid." Channel 4 is to invite pitches from cities across the UK to host the base, as well as other production hubs, in the biggest shake-up at the broadcaster in its 35-year history. Glasgow is likely to face keen competition from other cities, notably Birmingham. Alan Clements, the chief executive of STV Productions, said, "We're proud to be an integral part of the innovative, passionate hub of Glasgow's thriving creative industry sector, which boasts a superb, talented skills base and a strong record of success both nationally and internationally. We would be delighted to see a national headquarters for Channel 4 joining this exciting media environment, enabling the partnerships we already enjoy with the channel to be further enhanced and extended." The bid is being led by Glasgow City Council and has garnered support from the Scottish Government. Mr Cosgrove said Glasgow has everything that Channel 4 needs for its new headquarters, including a dynamic and original independent broadcast sector. He added, "The same qualities and values that typify Glasgow are ingrained in the culture and identity of Channel 4. They are bold and provocative with real heart. They both attract and celebrate innovative and diverse people. Channel 4 and Glasgow are made for one another." During his time at Channel 4, he represented the channel's programme team at board level. He chaired the Scottish Government's Digital Media Strategy Board on behalf of Scottish Enterprise. Mr Cosgrove is also an award-winning author. His most recent book, Memphis 68, The Tragedy of Southern Soul, was named winner of the 2018 Pindarin Music Book Prize on Sunday. Councillor Susan Aiken, leader of Glasgow City Council, said, "I'm delighted Stuart has agreed to chair Glasgow's bid. Both this city and the channel are clearly close to his heart, and there is nobody who better understands how the two can complement each other. The council expects to gather cross-party support for the endeavour." Yesterday, the Glasgow North East MP and Shadow Scotland Minister, Paul Sweeney, backed the plan, as did the Labour representatives on the council. However, he said a second independence referendum for Scotland could potentially derail the bid. Mr Sweeney said, "Glasgow has always had big ambitions, and becoming the main base for a UK-wide broadcaster would be a huge step towards our ambition to build a world-class media industry in the city." Glasgow already boasts an enviable pool of creative and technical talent in broadcast media production, with the BBC and STV forming the hub of our creative Clyde. I am certain that our magnificent, vibrant city can also attract the brightest and the best from everywhere in the UK. Councillor Eva Murray said Glasgow Labour has long actively campaigned for broadcasting and publishing to be based in our city, with facilities like the Glasgow Film Partnership and the Lighthouse demonstrating that our city is a centre of media and cultural excellence.
This article from the Herald Scotland News. On the 11th of April 2018, Team Scotland pass medal target. This article was unattributed. Scottish athletes are celebrating after securing the country's best ever medal haul in an overseas Commonwealth Games. David McMath won Scotland's 7th gold of the Gold Coast Games in the double tap shooting event in Australia, taking the medal tally to 30. Team Scotland won a record 53 medals at Glasgow 2014, but the previous best performance at any away games was in Melbourne in 2006 with 29 medals. Scotland's medal haul will grow over the next few days with Rhys McFadden and John Docherty in boxing semi-finals, where they are guaranteed at least bronze medals. Team leaders had set a target of at least 30 medals to take 2018 Scotland's best away Commonwealth Games, with early success in cycling and swimming setting the line. Duncan Scott claimed 6 medals in the pool, becoming Scotland's most decorated athlete at a single Games. Sport Scotland Chief Executive Stuart Harris said once again Team Scotland has delivered on the global stage with a string of sensational performances, surpassing our best ever performance at an away Games in the Gold Coast. For many of those medal winning athletes in 2018, Commonwealth Games marked the next step of an incredible sporting journey, and we are thrilled for each and every one of them. You have brought home a medal. I also want to thank the Sports Scotland team behind the team, who have helped ensure that Scotland's athletes are the best prepared they have ever been for any away games. They have put in hours of hard work behind the scenes with the athletes, and each and every one of them should be very proud of the results we have achieved. And while we are of course delighted at the medal success, I also want to pay tribute to the many athletes who received a personal best, and to every single member of the team for an incredible indication that they have shown to the games. This article was unattributed.
Sir Billy Connolly, I dislike people who write England off because they're Scottish. An article published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 10th of April 2018. Sir Billy Connolly has described himself as the least patriotic man in the world and said he dislikes people who write England off because they're Scottish. The Scottish actor and comedian, also known by his moniker The Biggian, will be seen in the first episode of Sky Art series Tate Britain's Great Art Walks, where he joins Gus Gaisley-Hayford on a walking tour which will focus on the influences of English painter Stanley Spencer. Asked about his choice of doing the programme, which focuses on a British painter, as a Scotsman, he told Radio Times, "I'm the least patriotic man in the world. I do love Scotland, but if the love for your country is all you have, you're in a desperate state. I dislike people that write England off because they're Scottish. It's unfair and brutal." The Glasgow-born star, aged 75, who has enjoyed a successful acting career alongside his life in comedy, revealed in 2013 that he was being treated for the initial symptoms of Parkinson's disease. He was knighted at Buckingham Palace in 2017 and said being given the honour was a bit nerve-wracking. He told Radio Times, "You don't want to make an arse of it. You think, oh God, don't trip, or worry you might make a rude noise. Since I've got Parkinson's, I'm a bit dodgy getting down on one knee. I don't do it all that well. And then I had to walk backwards to a certain point. But I managed it fine. I'm sure Prince William will think I'm a mentally ill person. I answered his questions in the most stupid fashion, just through nerves." Sibylle, who has been married to Pamela Stephenson for 28 years, said there was no secret to it at all when asked about their marriage. He added, if you listen to the song The Glory of Love, you've got to give a little, take a little, sometimes let your poor heart break a little. That's the story of, and that's the glory of love. It's all in there. He revealed the couple watch the Oscars ceremony annually and he makes macaroni and cheese. It's a ritual. Read the full interview in this week's Radio Times.
Article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 12th of April. Arts. Success for Festival of Silent Film. New contemporary art store opens. Rewind Scotland returns. This article by Phil Miller. The Hippodrome Silent Film Festival recorded a 3% increase in ticket income and had 5 sold-out shows this year. The success was registered over a 5-day festival in Bowness in March, the 8th running of the event. Alison Strauss, the festival director, said, "The Hippodrome has been vibrant with the immediacy of live music, silent film and enthusiastic cinema goers. The town has been positively thrumming with the festival atmosphere and you can feel the pride in the air. A first look at the feedback has shown how much impact the festival has. People really value the chance to see rare films, the gorgeous cinema, the calibre of the musicians, the inclusive atmosphere and the sense of fun. HipFest is organised by Falkirk Community Trust with funding from Falkirk Council and Creative Scotland's Opened Project Fund. For more information, go to www.hipfest.co.uk. That's HIPPFEST. A new online gallery led by the Glasgow-based contemporary artist Helen DeMann has been launched. From the Studio sells art from a selection of the studios of Scotland's contemporary artists. Featured artists include 2014 Turner Prize nominee Kiara Phillips, painter and printmaker Michael Fullerton and Franz Lees McGurn, currently exhibiting at Tate St Ives. 5 of the 7 artists featured on the website have work on show during Glasgow International Festival of Art, which begins this month. Ms DeMann has established the gallery with business partners Sinead Daly and Alexandra Petri. More information, go to www.fromthestudio.art. The Rewound Scotland Festival at Scone Palace, Perth, is to run on July the 20th to 22nd and will celebrate its 10th anniversary. It will feature a clutch of veteran bands including OMD, Status Quo, UB40, The Boomtown Rats, Majure, Roland Gift, Howard Jones, Bonnie Tyler, Heaven 17, Hue and Cry and Tiffany. It will include a 1980s DJ set by Martin Kemp and comedy by Reginald D. Hunter, Daisy Errol and Janie Godley. For more information, go to www.scotland.rewindfestival.com.
Rebus moves from page to stage. Rankin's detective brought to theatrical life in new mystery, Long Shadows. An article by Phil Miller, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 10th of April 2018. One of Scottish fiction's most famous characters is to finally make the move from the page to the stage, starring the actor who played Coronation Street's Jim MacDonald. Ian Rankin's iconic detective, Inspector Rebus, is to tread the boards for the first time in a new play written by Rankin and the leading Scottish playwright Rona Munro, with Charles Lawson in the title role. The new story, entitled Long Shadows, is to be part of the autumn season of the Birmingham Repertory Theatre. After its run in Birmingham, the show will tour, the theatre said, with a plan for it to be staged in Edinburgh, although details have yet to be confirmed. Roxana Silbert, director of the company, said she was particularly proud that Rankin, and in another production of Alice Sebold's The Lovely Bones, had entrusted us with bringing their stories to life in Birmingham. The world premiere of Rebus, Long Shadows, will be on September the 20th. The plot of the play is not adapted from an existing book, but is a new mystery. Rankin said, "I've long wanted to see John Rebus on a theatre stage, and it was such a privilege to work with Rona Munro in fashioning a brand new story that could best be told in the flesh. Having lived with Rebus for over 30 years, I know that he has cast many long shadows, but this time those same shadows threaten to engulf him in a story that is tense, gripping, deep and thoughtful. I hope audiences will agree." Munro, writer of the James plays for the National Theatre of Scotland, said, "Adapting one of the most iconic characters in detective fiction was both daunting and exhilarating. It was a collaborative process that completely depended on Ian Rankin's generosity in sharing the man he made and knows so well. We hope that audiences who also know Rebus will see him live, and that audiences who've never met the man are in for an exciting introduction." Rebus Long Shadows will be directed by Roxana Silbert. Lawson, from Enniskillen in Northern Ireland, first appeared in Coronation Street in 1989 and was a regular character for the next 11 years. He is known primarily for his work on television, also appearing in Doctors, Bread, The Bill and the television film The Firm. Tickets for Birmingham's Repertory Theatre's autumn and winter 2018 season go on sale on Monday the 16th of April. Inspector Rebus has had a varied life as a character in adaptations away from Rankin's books. John Hannah first played the role in the TV series before being succeeded as Ken Stott for a further three series which ran between 2000 and 2007. Ron Donaghy starred as Rebus in several BBC Radio 4 dramatisations. It has been reported that Rebus is due to return to the small screen. Last year, 11th Hour Films announced that it had acquired the television rights to the best-selling crime novels. Writer Gregory Burke said he was adapting the novels for TV, according to the production company. The Scottish playwright won plaudits for his play Black Watch and for his screenplay for the critically acclaimed film 71. 11th Hour Films said he will work up a, quotes, "bold and visionary take for a contemporary international TV audience," end of quotation. Mr. Burke added, "It is an honour and a privilege to have the opportunity to work on adapting an iconic character like John Rebus for television. As someone who has grown up and lives in southeast Scotland, Ian Rankin's best-selling books provide the perfect material to make a thrilling series about crime in the modern world." Rankin at the time said he had his fingers crossed that actor Ken Stott would reprise his role as the detective.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 12th of April. Business. Scottish Government seeks derogation on three-crop rule. This article by Rog Wood, farming correspondent. The Scottish Government is to seek derogation from implementing the crop diversification three-crop rule in Scotland for the 2018 scheme year. Rural Economy Secretary Fergus Ewing said, "The prolonged harvest and ongoing wet conditions had a serious knock-on effect on cereal farmers' ability to sow planned crops. This has already seen a reduction of around 20% of winter crops being established and significant delays for cereal farmers in sowing spring crops. This has immediately reduced options available to meet the three-crop rule for Scotland's cereal farmers. Given the ongoing weather conditions, it will require a period of continuous dry weather to allow spring planting to move ahead. As such, I can confirm that I have written to Commissioner Hogan seeking a one-season derogation from the three-crop rule. This is a sensible approach, which, if agreed by the EU, would provide much-needed relief to farmers across Scotland. NFU Scotland President Andrew McCormick welcomed the move and said, "With autumn plantings substantially down on the year and the cold, wet conditions of spring working against ground preparation and planting, the window of opportunity to plant and establish spring crops in 2018 is closing, and meeting the three-crop rule for many farmers would be almost impossible. Given the challenge, we want Scottish farmers to be able to plant crops that are economically viable and most likely to secure a market, rather than being obligated to plant crops late in the spring that may be unsuited to Scottish conditions and difficult to harvest later in 2018. Meanwhile, Rura insurer NFU Mutual is urging Scottish motorists to take extra care as prolonged harsh weather and limited highway maintenance programmes are taking their toll on countryside routes. People who live and work in rural areas already face huge problems with poorly maintained roads and higher risk of accidents and a lack of gritting during the winter months, warned Martin Malone, NFU's Mutual Manager for Scotland. The deteriorating state of rural roads has been exacerbated by the recent prolonged freezes. Further flooding also poses an additional hazard, as many potholes are disguised, he added. Figures from NFU Mutual reveal a 48% increase in the number of pothole claims from 2015 to 2017, with the total value of claims almost doubling over the same period. The insurer's figures form only part of the picture, as many motorists might seek recompense directly from the local authority, while others might weather the cost themselves rather than claim on their car insurance.
Article from Herald Scotland, 10th of April, 2018. Business. Crude price rally may have helped some firms in North Sea supply chain. The latest accounts from Saltire Energy provide a welcome sign the benefits of the partial recovery in the crude price since late 2016 are feeding through to the supply chain. Owned by Sir Oil Services veteran Mike Loggie, Saltire increased the valuation of the drilling equipment it rents out by around £14 million in the year to the 30th of June, citing the upturn in the oil and gas market during 2017. The move highlights the significance of the increase in the crude price to about $50 per barrel from a low of less than $30/BBL in the first quarter of 2016, which followed moves by major exporters to support the market. As Aberdeen-based Saltire had slashed the valuation of the assets by £43 million in the year to June 2016, the increase points to a marked improvement in the outlook for demand for the assets the firm supplies. Coming weeks after Shell announced plans to redevelop the giant Penguins field north of Scotland, the update will be welcomed by watchers of the North Sea oil services industry. Saltire supplies equipment used in the kind of exploration and field development work that was put on hold by many firms amid the sharp fall in the oil price from $115 per barrel in June 2014. However, it may not be wise to read too much into the experience of Saltire. Oil and Gas UK said last month that many areas of the supply chain were still struggling with the impact of the downturn and had yet to benefit from any upturn in activity. The industry body said drilling remained an area of serious concern.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 12th of April. Business. Tesco's turnaround looks complete as supermarket giant sees profits soar. This article by Kevin Scott, business correspondent. Tesco has beaten full-year forecasts with a 28% jump in operating profit as a better-than-expected fourth quarter helped push revenue up 2.3% to £51 billion. The £1.6 billion pre-exceptional operating profit, ahead of Tesco's £1.5 billion guidance, marks a major victory for Chief Executive Dave Lewis, who was hired in 2014 to turn around an ailing supermarket giant mired in an accounting scandal amid falling sales. Hailing another year of the strong progress, which ended with a ninth consecutive quarter of growth, Mr. Lewis said, "More people are choosing to shop at Tesco and our brand is stronger as customers recognise improvements in both quality and value." The UK business grew 2.2% in the year, with consistent strength in its fresh food offer, which outperformed the market in volume terms by 1.7%. The one drag on the performance was a 0.4% decline in general merchandising sales. Tesco's Irish and Central European business also saw growth of 2.7% and 0.3% respectively. The only blemish was a 10% decline in sales in Asia, where Tesco has changed its strategy away from unprofitable bulk sales and discount coupons. Growth in its superstores was up by 1.9% on a like-for-like basis and a 2.7% in its convenience estate. Online sales were up 5.1%. Market conditions have remained challenging, with continued cost price inflation, said Tesco. "We have worked hard with our supplier partners throughout the year to mitigate price increases wherever possible and made a significant investment in the first half to further hold back inflation and protect customers." Kantar World Panel research shows that Tesco's market share of the grocery market is 27.6%, consistent with the previous year. Its four big rivals, Sainsbury, Morrisons and the Walmart-owned Asda, all lost share. Richard Lim, Chief Executive of Retail Economics, said, "A laser-like focus on the core UK food business continues to deliver impressive gains. Deeper price investment, a more focused range and further asset disposals have slowed the loss of market share and boosted further improvements in profitability." There were improvements across the group's accounts, with operating margins improving by 57 basis points at 2.9%, in spite of biting food inflation. Net debt was reduced by £1.1 billion to £2.6 billion, while the group's pension deficit was reduced by £2.8 billion to £2.7 billion. This year saw Tesco complete the acquisition of wholesale group Booker, which gives it the opportunity to enter the restaurant and pub sector. Tesco said it expected to see a £60 million synergy benefit in year one, running to a cumulative £140 million in year two, before delivering annualised savings of £200 million by the end of the third year. Since the deal completed, Booker's chief executive, Charles Wilson, has replaced Matt Davis as head of Tesco's UK business. The performance has seen the return of a dividend of 3p. Laith Calaf, senior analyst at Hargreaves Lansdowne, said, "Overall, Dave Lewis will be pleased his strategy is starting to gain traction, with sales and margins heading in the right direction and the Booker acquisition in the bag." Tesco Bank saw revenue grow 3.9% year on year to £1.05 billion, with pre-exceptional operating profit climbing 10.2% to £173 million. The Edinburgh-based bank, which saw long-term chief executive Benny Higgins leave to be replaced in December by Jerry Mallon, said lending growth, which climbed 15.7% to £11.5 billion, was strong, driven by secured mortgage lending, which now comprises 26% of the lending portfolio. Customer deposits were up 9.2% to £9.2 billion. Shares closed yesterday up 7.2%, sending Tesco to the top of the FTSE 100 that remains 42% down over a five-year period, but up 50% on its January 16 low. If Tesco can maintain its momentum in an improving market, there could be more to come, said Mr. Calaf.
That's the end of part one. After the break, we'll be coming back with more great articles from the Herald Scotland. This is part two. Coming up.
Kenny McCaskill. It's time for a review of the whole structure of the NHS in Scotland.
Closures highlight need for town centres to evolve.
Dear Scotland, what's your problem with Sir Billy?
Why the Queen does not deserve such an ignoble honour.
Scots lawyers should face ethics action over shell firm abuse.
What the papers say on how Theresa May should respond to Syria chemical attack.
Nicola Sturgeon holds constructive talks during visit to China.
Celtic to face Rangers on Sunday the 29th of April as post-split fixtures are released.
Scott Booth. Aberdeen needs to win the Scottish Cup to be considered a great side.
Kilmarnock disappointed by post-split fixture schedule.
Kenny McCaskill. It's time for a review of the whole structure of the NHS in Scotland. An article published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 10th of April, 2018. NHS Tayside is the latest health board mired in a crisis, and it is no doubt it won't be the last. The chairman and chief executive have resigned or been sacked, and NHS Scotland has taken over or reallocated powers to others. There were financial challenges, that's for certain, though Tayside isn't alone in that, but using charitable funds to plug gaps most certainly crosses a line. It wouldn't be countenanced in a pub and should never be considered in a public body. The minister was left with no real alternative. Others, though, have faced issues, whether financial or in personnel, over the years, and it is more than a decade since NHS Argyll and Clyde was viewed as terminal and simply dispensed with, its responsibilities split between NHS Highland and NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde. It raises the questions, why have NHS boards, and if there is to be local accountability, which I and almost everyone else would agree with, then why the current model? There are now 14 such regional boards, though many, if not most people, might struggle to name them, let alone identify with them. There are, of course, some based on current local authorities, such as the Islands and Fife and Dumfries and Galloway. Others, though, are far harder to define and seem arbitrary in many cases. Many Glaswegians probably think it's NHS Glasgow not stretching down the water and across in the form of NHS Glasgow and Clyde. NHS Highland is not simply the council area but has Argyll and Bute tacked on. Likewise, many in Edinburgh will consider it's the capital alone, or some even that it replicates the former police constabulary in Lothian and Borders, not simply NHS Lothian. If the purpose of these boards is to provide local identification and democratic accountability, then they're failing, not just through particular incidents, as in Tayside, but more generally through a lack of knowledge and appreciation. For most folk, it's simply the NHS whose loving care embraces and yet whose bureaucracy strangles. They appreciate the care provided even if they complain about the officialdom that goes with it. Health boards only seem to come to attention when there are major failings or controversial decisions, and then they're lobbied and criticised extensively. Until then, they're just an amorphous mass. An attempt by the First Minister when Health Secretary to instigate elections for them was an unmitigated failure. The organisations are too big for people to identify with, and direct elections would simply have been a recipe for pressure groups and particular lobbies. That failure is no more lamented than the passing of the Argyll and Clyde Board. As a constituency MSP, I frequently required to interact with the NHS, whether on individual cases or wider issues of health service policy or plans. My experience was that the staff were very accessible, remarkably open, and strived to be helpful, especially with complaints. However, engagement with the wider board on policy was contrived, to say the least, and based around briefings that were occasionally informative, but invariably predicated on plans already decided upon in private. So there's a need for democratic scrutiny and accountability. Moreover, as financial and other challenges mount, the time has come to consider the overall structure, not just individual failings within the National Health Service. It is a revered institution, and for that reason, perhaps it's sometimes seen as being beyond criticism. But seeking to address its labyrinthine structures isn't criticism, but a requirement for the challenges ahead. Other public bodies have undergone change, from colleges to police, and they, of course, haven't been without significant failings and challenges. However, it has meant that they are better placed to meet the needs of the coming decades and to squeeze on public funds. The difficulty for health has been that the mantra has simply been about more cash, not about using it better. Many other public bodies have justifiably complained that they've required to change and become more streamlined. Why should health be so sacrosanct? Do we need so many boards and chiefs? Perhaps the clue is in the name. It's the National Health Service, though it delivers locally. Similar treatment and the absence of a postcode lottery is expected. Some of that now requires not just flexibility within health boards, but across them. There can be only so many specialist units in Scotland, and the need for a national service ever greater. But as health and social care integration becomes the issue and requirement locally, why is it boards, not councils, addressing it? Surely it's time for a review of NHS structures with a national board addressing wider needs, not just ministerial direction and local accountability through democratically elected councillors. There's many models, but the current one isn't working.
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 11th of April 2018. Opinion section. Closures highlight need for town centres to evolve. This article is from the Herald View. Those seeking for a real-life exemplification of the challenges faced by the modern high street could do worse than look at Glasgow's Sauchie Hall Street. At one end, a host of bars, clubs and restaurants keep the nighttime economy thriving. At the other end sits Buchanan Galleries, a covered mall that's home to John Lewis, one of the country's most successful retailers. In between is where the problem lies. The once thriving parade of shops looks old and tired, the retail mix clearly depleted. The loss of BHS in 2016 was a big blow to the area, followed last year by Greaves Sport and Dunn's. The recent devastating fire only adds to the feeling of decline. And the latest national data on retail closures simply reinforces this gloomy picture. Last year, Scots High Street lost a total of 148 stores, up from 112 the previous year, the equivalent of 5 closures a week. Glasgow and Edinburgh experienced the biggest number of losses, followed by Aberdeen and Dundee, but no city was immune. Indeed, Scotland's 4.48% reduction in shops was the biggest in Britain. Banks, convenience shops and travel agents took the biggest hit, with the PwC research suggesting that cafes, tea rooms, restaurants and bars, the sorts of independent spots we see cropping up in gentrified neighbourhoods, are on the increase. So, how should we try to make sense of the overall picture at a time when the service sector remains crucial to the whole Scottish economy? According to retail experts, there are various reasons for the increase in high street closures, corresponding to a wider economic picture that continues to be both fragile and complex. Internet retailers, particularly the likes of Amazon, continue to batter the high street by offering prices and deals that traditional stores simply cannot match. At the same time, consumer spending remains cautious, while the cost of employing staff is on the rise. Speak to the retail sector in Scotland and they will tell you that business rates continue to hurt them and stifle growth, especially since one of them, the so-called large business rate supplement, only applies north of the border. Many also highlight the recent rise in employer contributions to workplace pensions as an extra expense that could push some over the edge. Governments can tweak taxes and levies, but there's surely little they can do to reverse the inevitable trajectory of internet shopping. That doesn't mean that high street retailers can't or shouldn't try to fight back where they can, of course, especially when it comes to improving the experience for shoppers. As PwC points out, success on the high street these days is likely to depend on things such as how well retailers keep pace with customers' needs by merging the experience of shopping online with their in-store offer. Successful town centres are not just about shopping, of course. Indeed, bringing people into town with a strong offering of cultural events and entertainment is known to increase traffic to retailers. Closures, however, encourage a vicious circle of decline that can be hard to recover from. That's why these latest figures are so concerning. More stores and brands are likely to go under due to our changing shopping habits. But we will harm the fundamental fabric of life in our towns and cities if we allow our high streets to die. And that's why retailers must work more closely with the town centres they inhabit to maximise and modernise the overall offering. Governments should also consider new and innovative ways to help viable businesses start and grow. Our high streets represent more than bricks and mortar. They are links to our pasts, present and future, and must be shepherded through these tough transitional times. This article was from The Herald View.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 12th of April. Opinion. Dear Scotland, what's your problem with Sir Billy? This article by Alison Rout, Senior Politics and Features Writer. The Royal Observatory in Greenwich has been in the time business for several centuries, so it is a brave soul that seeks to teach it how to set watches, suck eggs, or anything else. Needs must, however. There is a surefire way, you see, to synchronise timepieces that does not involve visiting greenwichmeantime.com or dialling the speaking clock brought to you by O2 in the name of Zuckerberg. This method is known as SBC, or Sir Billy Connolly approach. Whenever the comedian says anything, however seemingly innocuous or inconsequential, about the land of his birth, you can guarantee that all heck will break loose within Scotland, and among those who claim attachment to it within 2 seconds. Connolly speaks, balloon goes up, 2 seconds max. Pavlov's dogs are giddy slackers in comparison. The cause this time was a Radio Times interview about a programme he has made on the painter Stanley Spencer. You can see it on Sky Arts next Tuesday. Connolly was asked why, as a Scotsman, he had chosen the Cookham-born Spencer as his subject. Given Connolly's own time in the shipyards, he could have linked it to Spencer's painting set on the Clyde during the Second World War and left it there. But where would be the fun in that? Instead, Connolly described himself as the least patriotic man in the world, adding for good measure, "I do love Scotland, but if the love for your country is all you have, you're in a desperate state. I dislike people that write England off because they're Scottish. It's unfair and brutal." He built the stage for a rammy and they came. Connolly's stance on Scottish independence had been treacherous, said one commentator on the Herald story. Others described him variously as an establishment fraud, a loyal court jester, yesterday's man, a London jock, a purveyor of dirty jokes. "Some of us remember where he started from," said someone in a variation of "I kent his feyther." Then there was perhaps the greatest insult of all. He was never funny anyway. One would like to think that SNP MP Pete Wishart, who has not had his troubles with the Twitterati to seek lately, is dropping Sir Billy a note of commiseration and solidarity. You can guarantee the same to and fro from Connolly took place in many a Scottish workplace, pub, and on sofas across the land. Just what is Scotland's big problem with the Biggin? He is, after all, a great success story. Born on the floor of a room and kitchen in Partick, he had more than a share of childhood horrors. From the shipyards, he went into music before turning full-time to comedy. Decades of global success followed, riches, houses, famous pals, the lot. His work for charity alone much of it unheralded, merits local hero status. But still, the pelters come. Connolly touches a nerve in us. Could it be that in him we see some unwelcome home truths about Scotland and ourselves? Even if that is the case, at this point in our history, such things can and should be viewed differently. Take, for instance, his moving away from Scotland. In this, he seemed to personify the old Johnsonian jibe about the noblest prospect a Scotsman ever sees being the high road that leads him to England. But Scots have been going out into the world for centuries. There is no shame in wanting to see the world, and a lot to be gained. In any case, a nationalist Scotland can be internationalist too. But what about those friendships with the royals? That court jester stuff, my friend the prince? That could be seen as the epitome of the Scottish cringe at work. Or it could be the opposite of the cringe, an example of self-confidence. Why should he not keep company with the royals? Do we not want every Scottish child to grow up thinking they're as good as anyone else? As for being a sellout, another frequently raised bugbear about Connolly, his comedy did more to expose some of the realities of life in certain parts of Scotland. He was funny about it, the coats on the bed and damp freezing houses, the casual violence of adults towards children, but there was genuine anger there as well. He was not the shortbread tin version of Scottishness, all sweetness and light for the tourists. Long before Trainspotting's Renton made plain his view of being Scottish, clue it rhymes with might, bright, light, etc., Connolly was expressing the same doubt. His truth-telling about old Labour-governed Scotland did not hinder the SNP cause. It may even have helped it. Fancy that. Which leads us to the next oft-heard criticism, perhaps the greatest one, that is his dislike of nationalism and patriotism. Even if he is living outside Scotland, Connolly is not one of us, a real Scot. According to this argument, he cannot love Scotland and believe in its potential the way someone who supports independence does. Indeed, in being against such things, he's actively anti-Scottish, with all the quotes to prove it. Didn't he call Holyrood a wee pretendy parliament? He did, but the push for more powers by SNP MSPs has been to the great extent built on the same opinion. Connolly has said loudly and often that he loves Scotland. He has also said that being Scottish is just one part of him and his life. He loves his country, but he is ambivalent towards it. As the Scottish independence referendum and subsequent never-ending debate has shown, Connolly is not alone in his mixed feelings. If you were to sum up such a stance towards a country that might reach for the catch-all Americanism, it's complicated. Sometimes it is. The more those in favour of independence fail to recognise this, the less likely it will be that they convert others to their cause. Billy Connolly is not the enemy, never was. He is but one voice among many, no more, no less, with the same right to his views as anyone else. When Scotland can be at home with that notion, it might finally be at peace with itself and what kind of country it wants to be.
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 11th of April, 2018. Opinion section. Why the Queen does not deserve such an ignoble honour. This article by literary editor and columnist Rosemary Goring. Royalty ain't what it used to be. What does the Queen have in common with Edward I, the Hammer of the Scots, and the psychopathic Henry VIII? Where's the resemblance with bloodthirsty Mary I, or hard-hearted Elizabeth I? Apart from a luxurious residence, more money than she can possibly spend, and the power to make minions quake, it's hard to find common ground between our matter-of-fact, studiously diplomatic and dutiful Elizabeth II and previous occupants of the throne. Not so long ago, the monarchy decided the fate of the country, and of individuals, often on a whim. God help the poor soul who fell foul of the crown while they were nursing a hangover. A twitch of a finger, a whispered command, and somebody's fate was sealed. At best, you'd find yourself thrown into the dungeons. At worst, your severed head would stare, goggle-eyed, from a spike on London Bridge, until the ravens had pecked it clean. The measure of how dramatically royal behaviour has changed comes with the recent proposal that the Queen be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Advocates of this original suggestion would like it to be conferred in recognition of her dedicated service for 65 years as head of the Commonwealth. Personally, while I'd rather live in a republic than as a subject of the House of Windsor, I wouldn't begrudge the Queen any honour or praise. None, that is, except this. By almost every standard, she is an exceptional individual, the most reliable and sensible head of state imaginable. Throughout the swiftest period of societal change ever known, she's kept abreast of modernity without losing her dignity or that of her position. The single possible blemish on her record is an old-fashioned aristocratic chilliness as a mother, and for that we are reliant on hearsay rather than documented fact. So when Frank Field MP endorsed offering the Queen the highest accolade for promoting accord between nations, who could object? Apparently it's the talk of the locker room among high commissioners, and has gathered support from a raft of government ministers. As Mr. Field observed, she would be a deserving winner for her determined diplomacy in keeping the Commonwealth alive and functioning. No one certainly should underplay her part in holding together this uneasy coalition, a relic of imperial dominion. Using a powerful blend of steely charm and artful understatement, the Queen has welded together a geographically, socially, and economically disparate and occasionally fractious community at a time when its purpose has frequently seemed unsure, its existence an embarrassing anomaly. Without her commitment to its preservation, it's easy to see this awkward alliance of competing interests withering and dying. But, as the shockwaves of our impending split from Europe make plain, it's better to maintain fellowship with other nations and to preserve historic links, rather than set ourselves adrift. Perhaps Mr. Field, an ardent Brexiter, is beginning to have second thoughts. Yet to add the Queen to the roster of Nobel Peace Laureates would be to sully her name. You need only think of previous winners to see why. The credentials of some recipients are not what you'd call pacific. Putting aside the bellicose Henry Kissinger, are Yasser Arafat or Menachem Begin and Aung San Suu Kyi the sort of people that she should be associated with? Even well-intentioned Barack Obama's nomination provoked ridicule, best summed up by Noam Chomsky when he wrote, "We might say that the achievement of doing nothing to advance peace places Obama on a considerably higher moral plane than some of the earlier recipients." Unfortunately for Mr. Obama and other holders of the prize who are honourable individuals, the job of President or Prime Minister inevitably involves tough militaristic decisions. However justified they might be, confrontational actions do not sit well with the pursuit of peace. To be admired as a model, Gandhi-like, of turning the other cheek is not, sadly, the purpose of our leaders, unless it happens to be in the country's best interests. This is where the Queen stands apart. As an apolitical figure, she, more than most Nobel candidates, cannot in future years be accused of hypocrisy or of betraying the principles of the award. More importantly, however, she should not be reduced to the level of those vying for credit or decoration, whose grip on power and the limelight is transitory. Unlike theirs, her role is for life. Since there is no title in the world higher than monarch, other perhaps than pope, is it wise to pull her down to the level of everyone else? Is that not like clipping her wings? I don't, of course, believe in the divine right of kings and queens, but none of us can seriously doubt that the Queen's reign has been committed to fostering unity rather than conflict. Prizes, however, are for those who compete. Elizabeth II is like the lonely long-distance runner, in a race all by herself that won't end until she drops. She needs no endorsement or flattery, least of all from a discredited and much-mocked institution. This article was by literary editor and columnist Rosemary Goring.
Article from Herald Scotland, 10th of April 2018, Politics. Scots lawyers should face ethics action over shell firm abuse. David Leask, Chief Reporter. Lawyers who act for Scotland's Panama-style secrecy firms face a career-ending crackdown under proposed new reforms. Some of the biggest names in corporate law north of the border provide addresses for shell companies which have failed to comply with even the most basic anti-money laundering rules. They do so amid growing concern that Scottish businesses facing the kind of ethical crisis over secret firms experienced in Switzerland over secret bank accounts. However, law firms which represent or host businesses which fail to reveal their owners and are therefore at risk of being abused by money launderers or tax avoiders can currently escape sanction. Campaigning solicitor Mike Daly, in today's Herald, has called on industry watchdog the Law Society to tighten its rules so that any lawyer continuing to act for an anonymous shell firm could face disciplinary action. His call comes after the UK government last year ordered all Scottish Limited Partnerships SLPs to name their person of significant control, effectively their owner if they had one, after a series of multi-billion pound laundering scandals highlighted by the Herald. Thousands of such SLPs, including hundreds registered at prestigious law firms, have failed to comply with this requirement. This means, Mr. Daly said, that they remain the perfect partner to a shell company in Panama City. Mr. Daly said, while SLPs and company law is generally reserved to Westminster, the regulation of Scotland's professions isn't. Why should Scottish solicitors, accountants, and others act for SLPs who flout the law? Simply explaining that the responsibility for compliance with transparency regulations rests with the SLP isn't good enough. This should be a matter of professional conduct and ethics. For example, it isn't in the public interest for Scottish solicitors to continue to provide services and/or host SLPs who ignore transparency regulations. There is a very real risk that continuing to act for SLPs with something to hide will damage the public interest and reputation of the legal profession in Scotland. The Law Society did not respond to the specific proposal from Mr. Daly. A spokeswoman, however, said, as the professional body and anti-money laundering regulator for Scottish solicitors, we would take robust disciplinary action against any solicitor who, through complicity or negligence, enables the use of SLPs or any other business structure for criminal activity. We regularly review our practice rules and fully support measures aimed at preventing the misuse of SLPs. With the support of the profession, we will continue to engage with lawmakers to introduce effective reform. Mr. Daly said he understood politicians in Holyrood across parties would be prepared to legislate if the Law Society itself failed to beef up its own regulations. Former SNP MP Roger Mullin has previously criticised the Law Society as being complacent about the abuse of Scottish shell firms by criminals, especially those overseas. Last month, he called for professionals, solicitors, accountants, and company formation agents to take a moral view on their clients. He said, "To me, this should be the central focus, not whether some law has been broken, but whether firms are operating ethically in providing a base from which others can engage in evil deeds under a cloak of anonymity." His former party colleague, Chris Stevens MP, has backed tighter professional regulation north of the border. He said, "The rise in the number of SLPs is alarming. As highlighted previously by the Herald, my former MP colleague, Roger Mullin, and others. I very much sympathise with the view that the Law Society of Scotland and other professional bodies should introduce a conduct rule to ensure transparency regulations are complied with. We need to use every lever to make it hard for fraudsters and those involved in international crime to money launder or evade tax." Scottish Labour's economy spokesperson, Jackie Bailey, MSP, stressed it was up to the UK government to prevent the abuse of SLPs and other similar instruments. The Tories at Westminster have signalled that they intend to carry out reform, especially amid evidence that Russian organised crime figures and Kremlin-friendly oligarchs use SLPs to launder money out of the former Soviet Union. But Miss Bailey too urged the Law Society to look at what it could do to police Scottish solicitors providing shell firms. She said, "It is absolutely shocking that murky companies and organised criminals are able to use Scotland as a base for their activities." Labour has repeatedly urged the UK government to act against those using SLPs to avoid tax or engage in illegal enterprise. "It is also right that our work to tackle the illicit use of SLPs should include a review of those who organise, operate and facilitate their use, including solicitors. The Law Society of Scotland should investigate what practical steps can be taken to help end the operation of SLPs for dubious means. Scottish Conservative Glasgow MSP Annie Wells said, "There's nothing wrong with the creation or existence of SLPs in themselves. But it does seem the system has been open to abuse, and that's not something any of us should stand for. We often think murky accounts, money laundering and tax evasion are problems for other countries. Clearly that's not the case, and it's important we don't allow SLPs to be used for questionable means."
The Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 12th of April 2018. Politics section. What the papers say on how Theresa May should respond to Syria chemical attack. This article unattributed. Theresa May faces calls in Britain's papers both for and against joining possible near-term US-led military action in Syria. The Prime Minister has also been urged to consult Parliament before committing British armed forces to strikes by American and French forces. According to reports, Mrs. May is set to defy calls to give the Commons a say over retaliatory action for a suspected gas attack. The Daily Mail says that Britain should support the US in all but the most exceptional circumstances, although the case for joining strikes has not yet been made. Nor has the case for justifying the Prime Minister's apparent willingness to intervene in a conflict that doesn't affect this country without involving Parliament, the paper says. If she is to do this, she must convince Britain we are not on the brink of repeating Tony Blair's calamitous mistake in Iraq. The Daily Mirror says that Donald Trump is out of control, and Mrs. May must not let him call the shots, favouring quiet resolve instead to turn the tables on the Assad regime. May must not be Trump's support act, the paper says. We detect no public appetite for entering war when it probably will not make a difference. In contrast, The Times says the atrocity in Douma cannot go unpunished, and military action is necessary to prevent further attacks in Syria or elsewhere. That is why Theresa May is right to have pledged British support for a joint military response with the US and France, the paper says. However, it cautions that strikes should only be carried out with a reasonable expectation that they will undermine Assad's chemical weapon capabilities. On Wednesday, The Guardian firmly objected to Mrs. May blindly following Mr. Trump into war and called for Britain to replace mindless confrontation with common sense and courage. To make some headway in resolving the conundrum of the Syrian civil war, there must be an articulation of a clear strategy in public, the paper said. This would allow the risks and benefits to be aired and a plan sanctioned by Parliament. The Sun also warned against rushing into action without evidence confirming an attack, but said the country should not be hung up on mistakes made in previous conflicts. "We can't stand idly by when innocent children are dying on the cold, hard floor of a Syrian hospital," the paper said. That might not necessarily mean a traditional military strike, though if an international coalition were formed, and firm intelligence suggested that targeted, limited action would destroy Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons stocks, this newspaper would support Britain's involvement. And the Daily Express said that, while Assad and backer Vladimir Putin should be held accountable, the West must not risk starting World War III. Some form of military action will probably be needed in Syria, but when it comes to dealing with the Russian bear itself, we should be cautious, the paper said. Mr. Putin has clearly been goading the West in any way he can for some time now, but we in Britain have particular cause to know. The best way of dealing with Russia is through sanctions. This article was unattributed.
This article from the Herald on Monday, the 9th of April 2018. Politics. Nicola Sturgeon holds constructive talks during visit to China. This article is unattributed. Nicola Sturgeon has held constructive talks with the Chinese Vice Premier during her official visit to the country. The First Minister said the discussions with Hu Chunhua had focused on strengthening cooperation between Scotland and China in the fields of trade and investment, education and culture. Ms. Sturgeon said she also raised the issue of human rights during the meeting in Beijing. Speaking afterwards, she said, "We had a very constructive discussion about the long-standing friendship between Scotland and China and how we can continue to develop this for the benefit of people in both countries. Today I was particularly interested to explore some of the main themes of my visit, trade and investment, education and culture, and made clear our commitment to continue to cooperate closely in these areas. There are clearly enormous opportunities for Scottish firms to do business in China. Sectors including energy, research and innovation and life sciences all offer significant potential for growth, and I will be working to strengthen relationships in these areas throughout the week. Our China strategy is underpinned by promoting equality and a respect for human rights, social values and the rule of law. This is a key part of our relationship. We discussed those subjects today, and also inclusive economic growth, women's rights and children's rights, the last of which I look forward to exploring more in my UNICEF speech tomorrow. Ms Sturgeon is visiting Beijing, Shanghai and Hong Kong during her five-day visit aimed at boosting trade and cultural links. The Scottish Government has come under pressure to publish human rights checks carried out on any deals struck after a controversial agreement in 2016. A memorandum of understanding was signed with the two state-backed Chinese firms, which later collapsed amid human rights concerns. This article is unattributed.
The Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 12th of April 2018, Sports Section. Celtic to face Rangers on Sunday the 29th of April, as post-split fixtures are released. This article by online sports editor Alistair McKenzie. The SPFL has confirmed that Celtic will face Rangers on Sunday the 29th of April, after the post-split Premiership fixtures were released on Wednesday. Build-up to the announcement was dominated by a potential title decider between the two rival clubs on the first weekend after the split, but the high-profile showdown has been avoided in favour of meeting a week later. Brendan Rodgers' side instead have the chance to secure a seventh consecutive league championship against Hibernian at Easter Road on Saturday the 20th of April, in the first clash of the round. The final Edinburgh derby of the season will take place on Wednesday the 9th of May, while in the race for second, Rangers face Aberdeen and Hibernian on the 8th and 13th of May respectively, while the Dons take on the Hibbies on Saturday the 5th of May. In the bottom six, the clash between bottom two Partick Thistle and Ross County will take place on Friday the 4th of May at 7:45 p.m. An SPFL spokesman said, "We want to thank supporters for the patience they have shown during the compilation of the post-split fixture schedule. Working with the 12 clubs, Police Scotland and our broadcast partners to produce a set of fixtures that meets everyone's requirements can often be a complex and time-consuming process, but fans can now look forward to an exciting conclusion to the Ladbrokes Premiership campaign." This article is accompanied by a table showing the fixtures, which are Round 34. Saturday the 21st of April. Hibernian v Celtic, 12:30, BT Sport. Dundee v St Johnstone, 1500. Partick Thistle v Hamilton Academical, 1500. Ross County v Motherwell, 1500. Kilmarnock v Aberdeen, 1500. Sunday the 22nd of April. Rangers v Hearts, 12:30, Sky Sports. Round 35. Friday the 27th of April. Aberdeen v Hearts, 1945, BT Sport. Saturday the 28th of April. Hamilton Academical v Ross County, 12:30, Sky Sports. Motherwell v Dundee, 1500. St Johnstone v Partick Thistle, 1500. Hibernian v Kilmarnock, 1500. Sunday the 29th of April. Celtic v Rangers, 1200 hours, Sky Sports. Round 36. Friday the 4th of May. Partick Thistle v Ross County, 1945, BT Sport. Saturday the 5th of May. Dundee v Hamilton Academical, 12:30, Sky Sports. Aberdeen v Hibernian, 1500. Motherwell v St Johnstone, 1500. Rangers v Kilmarnock, 1500. Sunday the 6th of May. Hearts v Celtic, 12:15, BT Sport. Round 37. Tuesday the 8th of May. Aberdeen v Rangers, 1945, Sky Sports. Hamilton Academical v St Johnstone, 1945. Partick Thistle v Motherwell, 1945. Ross County v Dundee, 1945. Wednesday the 9th of May. Celtic v Kilmarnock, 1945. Hearts v Hibernian, 1945, BT Sport. Round 38. Saturday the 12th of May. Dundee v Partick Thistle, 1500. Motherwell v Hamilton Academical, 1500. St Johnstone v Ross County, 1500. Sunday the 13th of May. Celtic v Aberdeen, 12:30, Sky Sports. Kilmarnock v Hearts, 12:30. Hibernian v Rangers, 12:30, BT Sport. This article was by online sports editor Alistair McKenzie.
Article from Herald Scotland, 10th of April 2018, Sports. Scott Booth: Aberdeen needs to win the Scottish Cup to be considered a great side. By Neil Cameron. A good team becomes a great team by winning trophies. Scott Booth, a hero at his hometown club for many years, scored goals for an Aberdeen side which enjoyed good seasons, played some fantastic football, but couldn't quite find that bit extra to beat a dominant Rangers side. And silverware is the true mark of success. Today, Aberdeen are the strongest since Booth's day. They've won the League Cup and finished second to Celtic, even more dominant than the Rangers team of the 1990s, and have lost two finals. That is a decent record, make no mistake, but Booth believes it's time for his old club to take another step forward. "Just winning things would be fantastic for Aberdeen," said Booth. "Under Derek McInnes, they have been a really good side for a number of years now. He has proved he can change the side, bring new players in and build. But for the fans, it's all about winning trophies, and they've had a lot of near misses. The Scottish Cup final, given Celtic are going to win the league, is the next best thing. It would be massive for them to take that trophy." If you're going to be a great manager, you need to win things. There is a level of expectation at Aberdeen that has always been high, but fans have realised how tough it is to win things. The players will be desperate to win the trophy because years on you look back on it. Did you win it or did you not? Aberdeen's last cup success came in 1990, if you can believe it, when Booth was a young lad watching in the stand. If they are to reach another final, they must beat Motherwell in Saturday's semi-final without the suspended captain Graham Shinney, ever-present Shea Logan and Kenny McLean, who has been Aberdeen's best player this season. "It's going to be really difficult to replace them. It's a real blow," said Booth. "Now it's about players stepping up, and that's what a squad is all about. You're talking about your captain and a player that creates goals and scores them, and they are the types that are so important in a cup semi-final."
The Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 12th of April 2018. Sports section. Kilmarnock disappointed by post-split fixture schedule. This article by online sports editor Alistair McKenzie. Kilmarnock have expressed disappointment at the post-split fixture list after the Scottish Professional Football League published the end-of-season schedule on Wednesday. The Rugby Park outfit faced three away games before the end of the campaign, including a third trip of the season against Rangers at Ibrox. Kelly said in a statement that they are frustrated by the missed opportunity to generate more income with another home clash against the Gers, but urged supporters to continue to back the team. It read, "Kilmarnock Football Club wishes to express its disappointment following the publication of the Scottish Premiership post-split fixtures. As has already been alluded to, there's always the possibility of an imbalance of home and away fixtures. This year we see a relative balance being struck, with the reallocation of additional home matches to another team in the league, which ultimately results in Kilmarnock FC facing three trips to Ibrox, with Rangers having made only one trip to Rugby Park. While we share the frustration of our supporters at this outcome, we hope you will continue to provide the magnificent backing you have shown to our team over the course of the season. The connection between the club and supporters has been a critical factor to our upturn in fortunes. While an additional visit by Rangers would naturally provide a boost in terms of income, the passion, ambition and focus of everyone at the club remains on continuing to grow our home crowds. Your strong vocal backing of the team has seen Rugby Park rocking and made our home a place our opponents respect once again. We are focused on finishing the campaign as strongly as possible and ask that our fans back us in numbers both home and away in our remaining matches of this fantastic season, and we look forward to the forthcoming launch of our season ticket campaign for the 2018-19 season over the next few weeks. Together, we are stronger." Kilmarnock are currently fifth in the Ladbrokes Premiership standings. Steve Clark picked up his third consecutive Manager of the Month award yesterday, while Stephen O'Donnell was named Player of the Month. This article was by online sports editor Alistair McKenzie. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland. This weekly talking newspaper digest was a Q&Review recording service production. The readers were volunteers at Q and Review, and the producer was Jay Kidd. Q and Review Recording Service Limited is a registered Scottish charity, number SC018016. Our registered office is at 18 Crowhill Road, Bishop Briggs, Glasgow, G641QY. Remember, you can always get in contact with us by email at information@qandreview.com or by leaving us a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976.